We are a beautiful collection of genes working as an orchestral masterpiece. So the goal of genetic testing shouldn't be these one-off independent genes. It should be genetic testing that helps us to understand pathways.
This is the Entrepology Podcast, the podcast where we optimize the bodies, brains, and lifestyles of entrepreneurs, go-getters, and world-changing innovators.
Welcome to the Entrepology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Walker. As an anthropologist and naturopathic doctor, I optimize the health and performance of badass women working to change the world as entrepreneurs and go-getters. We are these people, so listen up. Before we jump into the interview, I want to invite you to join our free Facebook community, Legacy. If you want to be something amazing, you need to surround yourself with amazing people. The Legacy community is made up of badass women living, not leaving, but living our legacy every single day. We are leaders, parents, entrepreneurs, and innovators collectively committed to leaving the world better than we found it. My mission is to support the health and optimization of these badass superheroes, literally to places we never thought imaginable. If you are on a mission and get it that your health is the key to your unlimited potential, then join us. We are super awesome. You can find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/groups/BE Legacy. See you there. So at the end of all my podcasts, I ask all my guests the same question. Entrepreneurism, are we born this way or do we learn to become entrepreneurs? Never has this question been more loaded than it was with my guest today. Dr. Mansoor Mohammed is a clinical geneticist, and what we looked at and talked about was the correlation and connection between our genetic makeup, our DNA, and our potential and our capacity for optimization in the world. We weren't looking at genetics from the perspective of markers of disease, but rather we went deep on the types of things we need to look for and understand if we're going to analyze our genetics and use it to make us effective in the world. We looked at ways that genetics can be used to optimize our nutrition and health. We touched briefly on risk factors, and then we got into the personality traits that we can actually look for in terms of markers and then cultivate and leverage to make ourselves more effective on our mission in making this world a better place. This was a fascinating interview because it's universally aligned to everybody. We all are made up of all of these genes. We each have this DNA imprint that sets the tone and the blueprint for who we become in this world. There's something to be learned for everyone from this interview, and Dr. Mohammed does not disappoint in his ability to eloquently go into and delve into the deep world of genetics in a highly accessible way. Dr. Mansoor Mohammed, it is such a pleasure to have you on the Anthropology Podcast. I have been waiting with bated breath for this interview because I have so much to ask. Welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. And I too have been looking forward to this, Megan. It's been a while.
Dr. Mohammed, you are a clinical genomicist, an entrepreneur, and a health optimizer. You focus on DNA, you focus on genetics. Is DNA in your DNA? How did you get here? Give us a little bit of a background on how you got to where you are today.
I'm actually a clinically trained cytogeneticist. So that's dating me a little there, Megan, meaning this was back in the days when we were still looking at chromosomes. And if you were to ask me, I would say chromosomes or DNA is in my chromosomes, which obviously is the exact point. But it was an absolute fascination, love affair of chromosomes that got me down this path. I mean, you know, whereas DNA is not something that you can actually see per se, you know, unless you have, exquisite microscopy, chromosomes, on the other hand, is something. I mean, we can produce and view chromosomes even in a high school lab. And the thought to me that we could actually, once I did in one of my introductory biology courses, prepared my own chromosomes and actually saw these little tiny things that were packaged in my cells, and to then be told that those tiny things that I'm actually looking at down that microscope contained all of the genetic material that led to the otherwise living, breathing Mansoor, to me just blew me away, and that I could see it and that I could differentiate it. Oh, there was chromosome one, and there's the little squiggly minuscule and inconsequential chromosome Y that made me a male. You know, those sort of, that was the introduction that had me absolutely fall in love with the world of genetics. So it was chromosomes that then led me along to wanting to know that I can see it, I can frankly touch it. Ask, what was that DNA? What's that thing that has been packaged into these chromosomes? That began the journey of my career.
And I can genuinely hear the love and fascination in your voice as you describe your passion. And I know that your experience has evolved to a place where you're involved in more testing and in teaching people how to take action based on their genetic testing. Can you briefly explain what we're talking about when we're talking about genetic tests and what information we're really garnering?
Certainly. I think one point that probably needs to be touched on very quickly is that for most of us, when we think of genetics, you know, a lot of folks, they get a general sense of the, you know, genetics. That's why my nose looks like more like mom and my chin more like dad. So in other words, we all have a sense that our genetic inheritance, which, by the way, when you think about it, we all pay attention to our inheritances, whether it's our name, our fortune, our legacy, our, you know, ethnic background. But honestly, the most important inheritance that we will ever inherit and that we might ever choose to pass on is our genetic inheritance. So it's something that when we stop for a moment, this inheritance, this thing that you've inherited, this operating manual that comes to you via mom and dad and dictates so much of how your body works in a unique manner, is your genetic inheritance. Okay? And so we get a sense that superficially, genetics has to do with how we look the way we look, on the one hand. And then, of course, my journey began using genetics, i.e., per what I initially started with, its use in bona fide disease diagnostics. So I initially trained as a cancer diagnostic specialist at UCLA, and then I went on to use genetic testing in developmental syndromes, you know, whether it be from Down syndrome to Prader-Willi syndrome to Angelman, the bona fide childhood developmental syndromes. And so these are the original categories in which genetic testing, the ability to look at this genetic manual that we all inherit and ask a simple question, is there a normalcy to this manual? Is there something that we can say, here is what this manual should look like when we would anticipate a normal and healthy outcome, number one. Number two, can we determine when something has affected that manual such that it would relate or indicate something that is absolutely and clearly suboptimal or abnormal? And the answer is yes. So that's where the genetic testing has borne fruit. However, more recently, and this is precisely the focus of what I'm doing now, is I started to feel and believe several years ago that why was it that we're only interested in our genetics, either from a very superficial perspective, as we mentioned, the color of your eyes or the type of hair you're going to have, or on the other side of the spectrum, this disease-centric, you know, is this mutation going to lead to such and such cancer, or is this deletion related to such and such childhood developmental abnormality? Why are we only looking at genetics in this polarized manner? In other words, there is so much more to genetics beyond just disease or beyond just a superficial perspective as it relates to our living, breathing every moment of our lives. How are we metabolizing the foods that we eat? How are we detoxifying when we live in the wonderful but frankly sometimes toxic environments that we live in? Why is it that my mood tendencies and behavioral tendencies are clearly in such a manner and I can tell, well, I'm not quite like person A, B, or C? All of these innate fundamental questions that are beyond superficiality, but not to the point that I'm waiting for some disease to happen, is what I call lifestyle genetics or lifestyle genomics. It's otherwise been called functional genomics. It's the genetics that helps us to understand how to be the optimal or the best that we can be. And this is the field of genetics that I'm involved in now.
And so I guess one of the questions people will ask is, what's the value in knowing? So can we just hedge our bets with a healthy lifestyle? Or is there a way to quantify the incremental benefit of genetic testing?
I personally, and clearly this comes from the bias of the person that you've heard speaking so passionately about this,
right.
But I personally think that the answer is we can absolutely improve that the opportunity or the chance of living an optimal life, an optimal healthy life, through the lenses of genetic information. And so one of the pictograms or visualizations I like to bring to my listeners or to patients when I speak to them is I tell them that when we think of our life and what we're trying to get out of it and health and wellness, picture an equilateral triangle, an equal-sided triangle, and the apices of this triangle are lifestyle, environment, and nutrition. Right? So in other words, what we're eating, how we're living, and the environment in which we're living. So these are the apices of this triangle that we've labeled. Now, to your point, we can all hedge a bet and we can all say, well, I'm going to eat the best that I, we'll eat the best quality foods and I'll eat healthy and I'll stay in my healthy range of whatever is deemed healthy for you vis-a-vis weight, vis-a-vis physical activity. My lifestyle is balanced and I try to keep a clean environment. Okay, that's fine. However, take that equilateral triangle and inside of it, draw a perfect fitting circle. So we now have a circle which is encapsulated within this equilateral triangle. That circle is your genetic legacy. It is the sum total of the genes that you've inherited from mom and dad. Okay? And optimal health, Megan, optimal health is found when that circle is perfectly resonant, perfectly encapsulated within that triangle. However, for most of us, our triangle of lifestyle, nutrition, and environment has been shifted. It is not in perfect resonance with the legacy of genes that we've inherited. And let me give you one very, very quick example. We live in Canada, beautiful country, Toronto more specifically, in my opinion, if not the most beautiful city, one of the most, beautiful cities in the world. But after all, it is a northern latitude, and after all, we do have several months of winter or, shorter days at least. Now, here I am, an island boy. By the way, I'm from Trinidad and Tobago, grew up in the islands. My forefathers are from the islands. So here I am, an island boy, came to this wonderful country, Toronto, when I was 16. Now, we all know that when we think of vitamin D, we understand that it's a radically important vitamin for health. In fact, so much so that we don't even refer to vitamin D as a vitamin anymore. It's considered a pro-hormone, as you well know. Now, in Canada and northern latitudes, we all think of we talk about having too little vitamin D, which is appropriate because we're in a northern latitude. And we expect that for several months, we're probably not getting as much sunlight as we would otherwise need, which, by the way, is the point. Our body makes vitamin D when we go into the sun, and this is correct. However, and here is now the beauty of taking genetic information and optimizing the decision that we make. So in Canada, we talk about, well, be a little careful, get your vitamin D checked, something that all individuals should do at some point in time, and ensure that your vitamin D levels are optimal. Okay, but what we're not told, and what most of us don't understand, is when we go into the sun, the vitamin D that we make is actually a precursor to the ultimately biologically active thing, vitamin, that our body really needs, that 125 dihydroxyvitamin D, that D3, which ultimately is the active version of that vitamin. We don't make that directly when we go in the sun. We make a precursor of that when we go in the sun. Now, there's a single gene, CYP2R1, that is responsible for activating that precursor into its ultimate active version. And guess what? That gene comes in different versions. Versions that are much more efficient at activating the precursor, the thing that you made when you were in the sun, and versions that are much less efficient. Now, coming back to the point that in Canada we all think of too little vitamin D, which is appropriate given the northern latitude, but there's also something as too much vitamin D. Now, think about this for a moment, Megan. If you make this precursor, this vitamin D precursor, when you're in the sun, And if having too much vitamin D can be problematic, how then me and my forefathers and anyone else who've come from an equatorial climate, i.e. a sunny climate, how did we survive? Did we have constantly a risk of vitamin D toxicity because we were out in the sun 8 hours a day, 365 days a year? And the answer is no. The answer is no because for many of us, people who come from a heritage, here comes that legacy all over again, we actually have, and I do specifically, we inherit a low efficiency version or a slow version of that CYP2R1. And beautifully, when we were living in an equatorial environment, a sunny environment, having the low efficiency version of CYP2R1 was not only okay, it was an adaptive advantage. You see, because now I can live in the sun, make tons and tons of the precursor, which is not yet biologically active, which is going to do me no harm nor any good until I activate it. And because my CYP2R1 gene is inefficient, I would only activate an appropriate amount of that precursor into the active version. Great. That served me well when I was living in the Caribbean. But now I move to Canada, and here I am as a 16-year-old boy, and now off winter after winter for 4 months, 3 months, 5 months, depending on, you know, my studying days or being indoors and so forth, my body is no longer making anywhere close to the amount of precursor, certainly in those months at least, than I would make in my youth on the sunny isles of the Caribbean. But on top of that, I also don't have the efficient CYP2R1. So here's the point. I couldn't hope to anticipate that me taking the average vitamin D dose of a Northern European would be adequate for me in my new context, in my new environment of Canada. So what happens is my circle, my genetic inheritance does not change, whether I'm living in the Caribbean or whether I'm living in Canada. But by moving to Canada, I shifted my triangle such that my environment is no longer in optimal harmony with my unique inheritance. And I must know this in order to then take steps that individually for me, for Mansoor, as probably different from Megan, I've got to take steps that are unique to optimize my health than you might have had to take in the context of this gene. Does that make sense, Megan?
It does. And it's what's ironic is I actually remember sitting down with you and you saying, huh, we have the same SNP on this particular gene.
And you know, and it speaks to probably something of your forefathers and where you're from. And if you look far enough back, you know, you probably would find that you were meant to be more of a sun baby than you otherwise realized.
I'm so glad you said that. I'm going to make sure I tell my husband that when I get home this evening. Yeah, it's fascinating. And I remember you telling a story, a few years ago about a patient that you'd worked with who was extremely vigilant with their health. They engaged in triathlons and they ate very, very well. And you ran a panel on this person and called them up immediately and said, I mean, listen, you are like in the highest possible risk category for having a heart attack. And it informed a huge spectrum of intervention, but probably ultimately save this person's life.
Indeed. In fact, he still to this very day, he actually gives, you know, sort of mini talks to when he goes in, because he's quite a successful businessman. And he often, almost always gives this example and says, you know, this saved my life, because frankly, anyone who would know this person back then and still to this day, he looked like the poster child of a athletic magazine. I mean, he's just one of the most wonderful people I've ever met. But secondly, he was just always fit. However, that person that is always fit now has a stent that frankly saved his life. And he had no clue of knowing what was happening inside of his body until he understood his genetic legacy.
Right. And it's why I really emphasize for people I work with and our listeners that being satisfied with the answer, you are fine, is a huge risk. It's a 50-50 toss in the air.
It is absolutely. And Megan, you know, since we have last, you know, it's been some time since we've spoken in detail, you know, if someone were to ask me now, Mansoor, what's your legacy? You know, Dr. Mansoor, what is your legacy? And I've done a few things by God's grace along the way, but you know, one of my absolute passion points right now is the genetics of hormone inheritance. You know, Megan, we have, if we do a survey of how many young females, women in North America, in Canada, have been on or are on reproductive birth control pills by the time they're 25, and I think you won't be surprised that that number is extremely high. And by no means am I trying to decry the use of the reproductive pill, by no means, however. But at the same time, we do understand that for some women, being on a reproductive pill, being on an estrogen-based reproductive pill, brings with it certain risk factors. And yet we have the ability to understand which of these women genetically. So just in other words, what I'm saying is taking things that are real life, that impact huge swaths of our population, that we know certain things can have risks. We sort of bury ourselves, you see, Megan, as you know this well, behind statistics. We say, well, you know, it's only a 5% increased risk for such and such to happen. But look at the danger of statistics. When we say doing such and such comes with a 5% increased risk of a negative outcome, what that makes us think is, well, there's a 95% risk of it not happening. That's not how biology or medicine works. You see, if you happen to be one of those people with the negative outcome, for you, it was 100%. And what statistics does is it takes that you, the 100% of it happening, and it diluted you, the 100% of it happening, against the backdrop of the 95 people that it did not happen with. And now all of a sudden we go, oh no, it's only a 5% risk. This is not, first of all, it's a travesty. Secondly, this is not real biology. We have to understand our unique risks, our unique outcome potentials, and hopefully then take appropriate and preventative and at least take informed decisions that better suit, you know, healthy outcomes.
And so, you know, in saying that, we have so many things that we can test for, and I know you're going to tell me this, I can't even answer this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. We can test for everything. Are there some key markers that we should be looking at? I mean, people will run their 23andMe and then they will throw it in some interpretive thing and then they go, like, there are hundreds of genes here. Like, are there some really key ones that they should just narrow in on and look at quickly?
Absolutely. So just again, sorry, not to derail the line of thought. What we're not advocating here testing the kitchen sink, the cupboard, the cabinetry, and everything in it. Okay, we absolutely have to be mature and understand that there's a lot that we don't know. We know less than what we know. So let's just be clear. There's a lot that we don't know. However, there are some pathways, and this is the first point to answer your question. Mm-hmm. When we do genetic testing, intelligent genetic testing is not about throwing up a list of genes, testing them, and somehow trying to make decisions or conclusions from them.
Right.
That is not how the human body works. We are not a collection of 22,000 odd genes doing their own thing. Rather, we are a beautiful collection of genes, as I used this sort of flowery example. We are a beautiful collection of genes working as an orchestral masterpiece. So the goal of genetic testing shouldn't be these one-off independent genes. It should be genetic testing that helps us to understand pathways. So we test the genes that we really understand are implicated in a pathway that has been studied, a pathway whose outcomes can be tested. And then we look at the genes that interact to create that pathway. That is intelligent genetic testing. So with that in mind, for example, you well know that one of the genes that is tested for in different circumstances is the MTHFR gene. Okay, so here's a gene, and it is a very important gene. It's received lots and lots. And I mean, just to be clear, these are not blogs. These are hundreds of peer-reviewed scientific journal articles on the type of genes such as MTHFR that we're talking about. So the data are strong. But the MTHFR gene, which is a gene that is involved in activating B9, folate, again, here we talk about another vitamin. And this is a common theme that when we think of vitamins, these super important micronutrients, we have to realize that for most, more often than not, these vitamins are precursors for something that will happen in our cells. Now, in the case of B9, folate, think green leafy vegetables, once we eat or consume that B9, that folate, and once it has been absorbed into our cells, that B9, that folate, has to be activated. MTHFR is the final gene which produces the MTHFR enzyme that does the job of activating that folate into something called methylfolate. But here's the point. There is a penultimate gene, the SHMT1 gene, that comes just before the MTHFR gene that is involved in that cascade, that pathway. And then beyond the MTHFR gene, after we have activated the folate into methylfolate, there are other genes that pick up the cascade and take it to its further ultimate conclusion, such as the MTRR and the MTR genes. So to answer your question in two paths, I've just listed for you some of the most. This is the cycle known as methylation. Methylation, the cellular process through which folate, B9, and B12, cobalamin, are simultaneously activated. These two radically important vitamins that work synergistically, that are activated, genetically activated synergistically, to formulate and execute a pathway, a fundamentally important pathway within our cells known as methylation. And methylation, this the cellular process, is so important in so many documentedly relevant outcomes. Methylation, as it relates to how we metabolize the neurochemicals in our brain. Methylation, as it relates to how we metabolize estrogen byproducts, some of which can be radically toxic if we're not metabolizing them. Methylation, as it relates to how we reduce inflammation on the lining of our blood vessels, inflammation on our neural pathways, nerve pathways. The singular metabolic pathway, methylation, has quite beautifully a determinable cascade of genes, SHMT1, MTHFR, MTR, MTRR, FUT2, and TCN. And frankly, those are wonderful. That's it there. We can add a couple more genes, but that collection of genes, when designed intelligently, tells us something that we can actually trace. We can work out the pathway. And so, to conclude this part of the answer, it is not just about picking individual genes, but rather it's about picking genes that work together, understanding that this is how the human body works, and then designing our tests accordingly. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it absolutely does. And the thing that strikes me in your answer, and I think it's an important takeaway, is this notion of single genes, where people say, mm-hmm. oh, you know, we'll just mm-hmm. test this for you and we're going to take all this action, mm-hmm. is dangerous.
Absolutely. And I'll give you something that was as poignant and relevant as now. It couldn't be more timely. As I mentioned to you earlier, when we were having a little chat, I did a podcast similar to this for the AHA, Autism Hope Alliance community, one of the largest autism supportive communities, just a wonderful group of individuals, passionate, many of them driven because they too have children that are on the autistic spectrum. And one lady in that group came to me and said, you know, Dr. Mansour, clearly her child had been diagnosed with autism. A fairly severe version of it in terms of, you know, he was on the spectrum, but a severe part of the spectrum. And she said to me, she goes, you know, Dr. Mansour, I don't understand it. My child, I was told that he has the normal version of the MTHFR gene. And she was rather confused because her doctors were telling her, and this was, by the way, through a research program, bona fide research program where they tested for the MTHFR gene and they told her, well, we can't really do much for you because your child has the normal version of MTHFR. And she left confused because she felt that how could her son have autism if he had the normal version of the MTHFR gene? And this brings up the point. You see, these single gene tests by no means will paint the entire picture. And so when I described to her that MTHFR, which yes, there have been some associations between that gene and variations that reduce the efficiency of that gene with as an association with autism, yes. But by the way, by no means, if you have a variation within the MTHFR gene, does that mean you will necessarily have autism? So clearly there are other things going on. But when I explained this to her, and when I explained the cascade, the pathway, first of all, she said, why isn't this information out there? Why was I left to believe for the last 2 years, struggling to understand that my son does have autism, and I thought that this was the gene that dictates whether he would or wouldn't, and I was told it was normal? So we can really do a better job of educating the population about what genetic testing is about and about the pitfalls of thinking of single gene testing and trying to take away, you know, have takeaways from single genes. So this is number one. But number two, Megan, fast forward, her son, we did a screen for him. And here was what was remarkable. Not only did we confirm, obviously, that his MTHFR gene was, that the variations that are known to exist within that gene, he carries the optimal version of those variations. That was already known, and we confirmed that. However, we did discover and determine that it was his SHMT1 gene, the gene just before in the cascade, just before the MTHFR gene. That gene, he contained a variation that radically reduced the efficiency of the SHMT1 gene and its encoded enzyme, which of course cascades to disrupt B9 metabolic pathway. That's number one. But you know what, Megan? That child carries the double deletion of two radically important detox genes, which this will, of course, ring your, you know, the GST genes I'm speaking of here. And he carries that very, very rare dual deletion, the complete, not a variation, the complete deletion. This is how he was born. This is how he was developing in utero. The complete deletion of two of the body's most important detox genes. And none of this was looked at for this child. So again, we come back to, it's not about single gene testing, Megan. It's about intelligent, pathway-driven. It's about not removing the medical discourse, the clinical, the functional discourse, but simply using genetics as a more informed manner. Genetics does not replace medicine. Genetics does not replace the need of a good clinician. Genetics is a tool that informs that clinician about things that they should look at closer, things that they should consider in the bigger picture of that person's health. Does that make sense?
Totally does. It's such, I'm smiling as we're talking about this because it's just so fascinating, the interface between environment and real life and circumstance and story and that genetic picture. It's complex. And anyone who tries to suggest that there's one or two genes and we can look at it and act on it, it should be a red flag for people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, and it also brings a very, very quick point here, Megan. And I've seen reports, and this is by no means, it's not my style in the least to ever pick apart reports that are out there or panels that are out there. But one comes to mind without the name, of course, and that is, it was a report that had to do with athleticism. And in the report, certain genes were being tested, and there was a particular gene. I won't name any things just to keep it, but just the overall concept. So there was a gene purportedly associated with muscle performance. And so the result of this gene would then dictate whether you should have or engage in more aerobic activity or more weightlifting activity and so forth. Now, different variations within the same gene, which brings an important point, that a gene, which is an instruction, a gene is that paragraph within your instructional manual telling your body how to accomplish some job. Now, in that paragraph, there are certain places in that paragraph that may be varied, and the ability to detect these variations within this paragraph, within this gene, helps us to understand the efficiency of that gene, i.e. the efficiency of the job that that gene was going to tell the cell how to do. Now, what people don't realize, or some people don't, it's that genes can have, any one gene can have sometimes multiple places within it that can be variable, which of course complicates the discussion. But in this particular test, a couple different places within the same gene were being tested. And here's the output. So you've got the same gene for the same patient. Different points within the gene were being tested. And the result comes out, variation number one within the same gene says, you are more likely to benefit from aerobic exercise. Variation number two within the same gene says, you are more likely to benefit from weight-bearing exercises and should avoid more strenuous aerobic exercises. Well, this is the same person.
Right.
And the same gene within the same person. What do I do? Do I do aerobic? Do I do weightlifting? This is not
too... You sit on the couch.
So exactly, right? And I think that this type of taking genetics and representing it in this manner does an injustice for a couple of reasons. Well, one, it's confusing. And two, it obviously then tells for some folks, they'll say, you see, this is why genetics is all fluff and it's all superficial and it's nonsense. By no means. By no means is it nonsensical. By no means does it, that it does not have value. It has huge value if and when done in a purposeful and intelligent manner.
So if we do that, and it's, I can understand looking at, athletic or physical strength and performance things and detox pathways. What about personality? Do we have any handle on whether or not someone has a propensity towards confidence or anxiety or extroversion or introversion? Are we getting there?
Hugely. And in fact, it's one of my subspecialties that I've... I've always known myself for who I am, and people that meet me would say, gosh, Dr. Mansour, you're quite the extrovert, and nothing could be further from the truth. I was probably, ask my parents, I was probably the most introverted young man and child that you would ever meet. And so I've known this, I've known my internal disposition, but obviously over the years, you're thrust into places where you have to learn to adapt. So the concept of our personalities, especially for our youth, for our children in school systems that obviously demand a homogeneity of how we teach and how we learn and what we expect from children. And of course, on top of all of that, it seems as though we're trying to label children more and more. The moment that a child is introverted, we're worried, is he on a spectrum? Is something wrong with him? As though introversion in and of itself is a disease, which is obviously, as you can tell from the tone of my voice, I hope isn't what people are chasing. So to answer your question, by all means, are we getting important, actionable, beautiful insights into personality characteristics through the lenses of genetics? But of course, again, to my point, that genetic makeup, which will set the standard, which will set the foundation of your more natural disposition, clearly, must then be colored by, in my case, for example, people look at me, think I'm extroverted. Does that mean that my genetics is inclined, or that my genetics, which, by the way, is absolutely consistent with my introversion, was that genetic result wrong? No. Through my environment, my lifestyle, my adaptation, I learned a particular skill. So now to answer the more detailed question about what is going on in that world of personality and behavior, there are several key genes that are being studied and have been studied. And one of the most remarkable of them is the BDNF gene, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Mm-hmm. And the name, this gene tells it all. First and foremost, it is derived from the brain-derived. Neurotrophic, a trophic is something, it's a food. So in other words, this is a factor, it is a thing found in the brain that serves as food for the neurons of the brain. And the name says exactly what it does. So BDNF is this protein in the brain that serves to, it's a nutrient for the health and for the longevity of the neurons, simply stated, in the brain. And I liken this protein, when people ask me about it, about this gene, I say, I call it fondly the telephone operator of the brain. You see, if we all have those images back in the day where you'd have your telephone operator with a switchboard and they're plugging and playing, their connections, trying to find an open line, this is one of the jobs, this is one of the things that has to happen in our brain. We're constantly assuaged, we're constantly affected by all of these stimuli in our environment, and our brains have to process these stimuli, these thought processes, these emotional impacts that we have going through life, going through our day. And BDNF is one of those genes that keeps the brain, the elasticity of the brain, that allows our neural networks to rewire themselves to circumvent, quote unquote, busy signals. So here's the point. The BDNF gene does have an extremely well-studied variation within it, the gene, such that one of those, one version of that SNP, produces lower levels of BDNF in the brain than the other version. In other words, we can determine, quite deterministically, we can determine if a person is more likely to produce optimal levels, higher levels of BDNF versus someone who produces low levels of BDNF. And I am one of those individuals that openly, both copies of my BDNF gene are the suboptimal versions of that gene. I produce low levels. And by the way, this is measurable. I produce low levels of BDNF. Now, here are some important take-homes. Hugely studied. This is not one study. This is not 50 people. These are dozens of high-level publications and studies. Individuals with low levels of BDNF, number one, are at a much greater risk when it comes to recuperation from concussions. So much so now that in the athletic world, sports teams are testing for this gene to inform themselves, is their athlete, does he or she have the low level of the gene? And if so, and if he or she suffers from a concussion, the steps that one will take for such a person is much more deliberate than another person that has the optimal version of BDNF. But when it comes to personality, individuals that have the low levels of BDNF, such as myself, what happens is this, Megan. We don't have enough of that thing that allows the brain to circumvent, to rewire, to find alternative neural pathways when challenged with a particular, you know, emotion. Simply stated, these individuals have been found to be much more likely to be neurotic. In other words, if and when there's an emotional disturbance, something that gets into our psyche that bothers us, BDNF would have been the thing that helped us to circumvent and get over that event. Individuals with low levels of BDNF, we run the much greater risk of falling into what we call the hamster wheel brain, you know, where this thing, this emotion, that memory, that circumstance keeps playing over and over and over, and we're looking at it from 12 different ways and reliving the event because it is as though our brain has hit a busy signal and we don't know how to circumvent that busy signal. Hugely impactful, this gene studied for, these children with low levels of BDNF are much more likely to be introverted. Well, for good reason. For good reason, because when we are in situations where there are, you know, multiple levels of activities and neural stimulation, for us, nothing feels quite like just returning to the quiet and peace of our space. And that was and still is me.
The one thing that I find so striking about this, and for me, you know, I'm kind of interested in my children's genetics. The one thing I'm scared of is that I look at any of these genes mm-hmm. and it changes how I parent them. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because mm-hmm. I adapt my style to their mm-hmm. their genetic blueprint.
Yes.
As opposed to enabling that blueprint to just inform how they engage with the yes. world or new opportunities. Yes. What percentage of our personalities or of our life or of our ultimate manifestations are genetic versus environmental?
It's a beautiful yet loaded question. And the way you framed it is perfect. So honestly, being in it, and I suppose my claim to fame is I've probably now seen and reviewed at a personal level, meaning sitting with actual patients, reviewing their results, I've reviewed literally thousands of individuals. And I must say that at least in my own personal experience, mind you, and it's only the experience of one person, I must say that I found, you know, as a clinician, I see the patient results before I see the patient, you know. So oftentimes working in a clinic, a sample is sent to me that goes off to the lab. I get the results, I get the report, and then I'm preparing for that consult, at which point I'm going to see the person for the first time. And, you know, Megan, I must say that I've begun to anticipate who is about to come see me. In other words, I've begun to be able to see those trends, as any good clinician is able to do or should be able to do. So the answer is partly that genetic makeup does, Megan, have a significant impact on a person's mood, behavior, behavioral traits. It does. Whether that is a 70% impact, a 50% impact, I think I would be naive to try to put a number on it because it is significant. But of course, then that person's environment, their upbringing, their sense of security, their sense of a parent who gave them the room to develop and did not pigeonhole them, which of course comes back to the beautiful way in which you frame this, that gave them the room to develop beyond thinking, well, if this is the way you're going to be, I'm going to treat you specifically in that way. So none of this information should ever be used to somehow label or pigeonhole or limit the wonderful horizon of an individual, but rather it does help us to understand that when we see tendencies, when we see the differences, the beautiful differences in children, that we're not left going, why can't you be more like such and such, which of course is a horrible attribute to have as a parent, obviously. I hope not too many of us have that, but it at least helps us to appreciate that there are differences that are inherent to a child, to an individual, and that we can celebrate and that we can learn to give the room, and by the way, if and when needed, to help that child overcome certain things. So for example, there are going to be genetic tendencies that increase the likelihood that someone's going to be more disposed to anxiety. Exceedingly well studied. There are genetic tendencies, genes, determinable, that are going to be implicated in whether is that child going to find as much fulfillment? Is he or she able to derive pleasure, derive that enthusiasm out of certain activities? And if the answer to that is no, and I'm seeing this child not being able to focus, not being able to engage as someone else, what do I do? Do I say he's stubborn or she's stubborn? By God's grace, no. But that I can understand that what it's going to take to have this child be engaged, to create the environment for this child to be more, you know, to fulfill his or her full potential, might and should be somewhat different. So these are the ways in which I wouldn't, I'd encourage people to use this information.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And as you're talking from my side, forever the entrepreneur, I'm thinking, wow, this would make for an incredible online dating service.
Oh my God. So you are, Megan, I kid you not, I literally had an investor group come to me and ask if I would create genome personality profiling for a dating site.
Come
and I looked
on.
At, you don't quite want to know what my response was, but anyway. So.
I don't know. I think there's a market there. My genes are my instinct genes are telling me that that's a thing. Really quickly, one thing I just want to touch base on is privacy laws with respect to genetic information. And so if I have this profile done and I sit back and I go, whoa, you know, I'm at increased risk for this or I may develop this. None of these things are sure things. And we've had traditional tools to assess risk. What are people required to disclose?
So let me make a major disclaimer here, and that is the jurisdiction, the type of thought processes that are going into making the answer to the question you just asked me is still completely up in the air as it relates to Canada. So in the US, for example, there is a bona fide Supreme Court ruling vis-a-vis your Genetic Privacy Act. So there is a genetic privacy law. There are things that you are by no means required to disclose, and you cannot be discriminated based on your genetic makeup. Now, in Canada, we do not yet have a bona fide Genetic Privacy or Genetic Protection Act. It is actually, serendipitously as we speak, it is and it has been tabled for discussion by Health Canada, and so the powers to be are looking at this conundrum that, you know, wait a minute, as you, I'm sure you understand where this is going, will an insurance company be able to look at my profile and say, well, because of such and such, even though I am asymptomatic, I have none of the issues, it's simply a risk. Will they be able to discriminate or increase my policy or whatever the case might be? And so to answer your question, number one, the regulations and the discussions around that are actively taking place. However, how do I talk to patients about this? And this is me personally, and I have no, you know, piece of regulatory jurisdiction that tells me this. It is as follows. Everything that we're discussing and doing here is based on research. There is no clinical, it is a risk. There's no clinical hardwired outcome. So in my opinion, I do not take any of this genetic information, for example, and put it in a patient's file. In other words, I consider it to be something they did as research. It is for their self-empowerment, for the empowerment of their clinicians that help them, you know, to the things that are actionable. But it does not formulate any definitive outcome and therefore cannot be used to discriminate against that. That is my personal opinion. And when asked, and I have been asked by some of our regulatory agencies, and this is the answer that I give them, until such a day that there's a gene that does have some definitive outcome, and even then, you know, there are thought patterns, and there are things that have to go into place as to how we would use that information in that person's health file. So to summarize, nothing that I have said, it's this discussion point is being addressed. It's alive. It's a very contentious point. So there's no firm outcome, especially in Canada. I advise my patients that if ever they get this, that they shouldn't shy away from getting this information, but it is not information as of yet that they are obliged to share for the simple reason that this is a research tool. It is research, and there's nothing in this information that has been carved with a definitive outcome.
Yeah, it's a great answer. I mean, like most things, you need to actively protect your own privacy.
Absolutely, and the patient, the onus is going to be on the patient, and of course their clinician or their clinic that you know encourages them and takes the step to make sure that these bits of information can be de-identified or protected in a way that protects the patient. Absolutely, and you know I give a simple example, Megan, to close on this point. You know, we might say that you know a study might come out and says that practicing yoga 3 times a week. Reduces heart disease of some particular variety. And this might very well be true. Does this mean that if I don't practice yoga 3 times a week, that I should be discriminated against, i.e. that I should be put in a higher cardiovascular risk profile? And the answer is absolutely not. It's bona fide ridiculous. I'm not saying yoga isn't good. I'm saying that to try to use that information and somehow calibrate my risk is ridiculous. And even though this may seem somewhat mundane and away from the discussion of genetics, it's frankly still related. Right now, that genetic information is something that can empower us, probably, yes. It is a research tool, and we should not be held accountable for that information. And there's just too much more information to be flushed out and to be studied to try to say that that information can be used or should be used to bias against anyone.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Dr. Mohammed, how would you define health?
I would define health as the context within which a person lives to their optimal desire or optimal potential. And the optimal potential of one person to the next does not have to be the same. So in other words, optimal health for me is simply that which facilitates my optimal performance, my outcome. What do I want in life? How do I want? And, you know, the topics are addressed. Well, do you want to live? How long do you want to live? I answer that by, it's not so much how long I want to live. I want to live however long I live and be healthy. I want to be optimal in my life. And so I make health and optimal living synonymous. And that's just my personal perspective.
No, I love it. I think we share a perspective in that way. Each month, I'm featuring a new Anthropology quiz to help you unlock and uncover some of the physical performance blocks that may be holding you back from your true potential. When you know better, you can do better. To learn more or to take the quiz, head on over to meganwalker.com/Anthropology quiz. Mansoor, so for the second half of the interview, and by second half, I mean it's like 5 minutes.
Yes.
We look at something called KPIs or key performance indicators. So just like you would have those in a startup, I believe that we have those in our life as well. And these are a series of five questions that I ask every guest that I have on the podcast. And I'm going to quickly throw them your way.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a consistent morning routine? And if so, can you share?
Absolutely. No, it's a little bit off the beaten path. I wake at about 4 a.m. every morning for about 15 to 20 minutes of mindfulness, prayer, and meditation.
I love it. And just so everyone knows, that is a genetic fluke that people want to wake up at 4 a.m.
I've been doing this for many, 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 many years.
I love it. I love it. Fiction or nonfiction, what are you reading right now?
Fiction. I have been hooked on one genre in particular, science fantasy, a couple of authors, Jim Butcher being one of my favorites. And why? I think the world that we live in, sometimes it's truly wonderful to just to get away from reality.
For sure.
And immerse oneself into just a beautiful sense of, wow, I wish it could have been this way.
It's great. Hot beverage of choice. How do you prepare it? And what might it be?
100% unsweetened organic cacao. I think it's Peruvian or Ecuadorian. I forget which one that I'm on now. It's mixed with some organic almond milk. So 2 tablespoons of 100% pure organic unsweetened cacao powder in a hot piping cup of almond milk, lightly sweetened with some honey. It is the beverage of kings and queens.
That sounds amazing. That will be in our show notes, everyone. You can check that out. What do you do for fun or play?
And I know this sounds cliche, spending time with my wife and kids. My life has taken me, I'm constantly living on a plane, I'm constantly sleeping in hotels. Nothing speaks fun and relaxation as walking back through the doors of my own home, seeing my kids, seeing my wife, sitting back, watching a movie, playing a board game, heading out. And just, you know, last night they were down at the waterfront waiting for me to finish my day at the clinic, and then we had dinner downtown together. We live in a vibrant, awesome city, summertime's in Toronto, just getting out, hitting one of our local restaurants, which, by the way, broke our diet last night, mind you. But having said that, family is where it's at for me.
It's great. And the final question, and I don't think this question has ever had more meaning or more weight associated with it, but entrepreneurism, are we born this way or do we learn to become entrepreneurs?
Wow. You know, I think you probably heard of, there's a book called Snake in Suits, I think. So there are definitely some people that are born to be the serial entrepreneurs, always chasing. And by the way, it is genetic, chasing that fix. And so that thrill, that drive to, you know, they're those. I'm not one of them. However, I do think that most of us, when we stumble upon something that we're passionate about, it doesn't have to be 50 different things we do, but when you find that thing that you're passionate about, if you see that it is not being delivered at the best level possible, in the most optimal and, you know, best service possible, I think there's this thing in us that when we're passionate about something and we've fallen in love with something, we want to bring it to the population. We want to bring it to folks and say, hey, this is something that can change your lives. And so I think there are two types of entrepreneurs, those that chase it for the thrill of doing something new and novel every however often. And then there are those who, because of what they do, what they love, when they find that thing and they fall in love with it, they want to share it with the world. And then often that can lead to entrepreneurism. That's the category I fall in.
That's great. What a great way to end. And I love that you brought the personal experience and your genetic knowledge to that question that I ask all my guests. Dr. Mohammed, you're up to some incredible things. I know people are going to want to follow up with you and have access to your knowledge and wisdom. Where can they find you and learn more about what you're doing right now?
So there are a couple of clinics that I practice out of. I'm simply blessed. And honestly, what I offer is minuscule compared to the clinicians that I work with that change lives daily. I'm exceedingly proud to work out of the P3 clinic in downtown Toronto. People can find me there. It's the P3 health clinic. That's my primary health clinic. And then I'm involved in a novel project something that I think is really going to change the world here, and that sounds gratuitous or, you know, large, and it's called Utrients, Y-O-U-T-R-I-E-N-T-S, and it's a perfect place for me to end. It is a brand new enterprise that is attempting to use the world of genetics and all of these wonderful things that we've spoken about in an intelligent, deep, meaningful manner, and use that to educate what are the food groups, the nutrients, the derivatives that lead to optimal health. It's only a small piece of the pie of optimal health, but is a critical part of the pie. And so you can catch me at, or get me at, Mansoor, M-A-N-S-O-O-R, at Utrients, Y-O-U-T-R-I-E-N-T-S.me. And the .me was purposeful because it's about the individual.
Yeah, it's just great. And we'll have all of that information in our show notes so that people can access you after they've had the opportunity to listen to everything that you have had to say. It's been a pleasure having you on the podcast. Thanks so much for being here.
Likewise, Megan. Absolutely. Thank you so much. And thank you to the visitors, the listeners who took the time to listen to this.
If you enjoyed our conversation and would like to hear more, head on over to Stitcher or iTunes and subscribe to the Entrepology Podcast. We would also really appreciate a quick review. When people have their health, they can change the world. Let us keep you healthy and you go change the world.